Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here in the middle of March 2020. We are just about a week away from spring equinox and just about a week past the first sunny day, first day of only a trace of precipitation in almost 7 weeks. It was quite a record. I guess it set the record actually for the airport at 48 days in a row of measurable precipitation. The old Geodetic Way Magnetic Observatory had a period in 1986 where there was 52 straight days of without precipitation. And I, a brief check around southeast, I saw there was a time in Ketchikan where there were 88 straight days, but that was back in the 1920s. So I doubt anybody alive still remembers that. It's been a good time. It's been nice to see some sunshine here the last few days, although chilly temperatures, the birds are still responding to the spring-like conditions of a greater daylight, and many birds still around the neighborhoods, but definitely getting their song on a little more, including the varied thrushes, song sparrows, and dark-eyed juncos, and no doubt we'll start seeing a greater influx of migrants in the coming weeks, which I'm looking forward to. The conversation I have for this week's show is one I recorded this past week with Sitkin Taylor White. She has been studying abalone for the last 5 years as part of a PhD program through the University of California, Santa Cruz. And I was interested to talk to her a little bit about what she's learned so far studying abalone in Sitka Sound and elsewhere around Southeast Alaska. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. What inspired you to study abalone?
Oh, that's a good question. Beyond that it's just a great opportunity to dive and do really fun field work, I definitely at least have a relationship with abalone growing up in Sitka and free diving for them in high school and on college breaks, and noticing there were fewer and fewer of them at low tide here. And then noticing that they were just really impossible to find legal sized ones. It was like 3¾-inch abalone were just so rare. And that was my relationship with abalone, and they're beautiful.
So yeah,
you can't hate on abalone shells. They're insanely gorgeous.
It's been an interesting story. Yeah. Cause same when I was growing up, they weren't that hard to find and you could go out and get them pretty easily. And then sometime when I was in college and graduate school, they disappeared. So that was through the '90s, and I came back full time in 2002, and where people were like, well, there aren't really abalone around anymore. And I think still some people snorkeled for them and could find them sometimes or something. I don't know. But it was interesting. So you started your work in 2015. Is that?
Yeah, basically it started. Well, there was a diving conference here in 2014 to sort of scout out where abalone might be in the sound in terms of if we wanted to create long-term monitoring plots for abalone in the sound. And then in 2015, we took from 21 randomly selected sites. We had like 8 that were going to be long-term monitoring sites. And now we've been monitoring just 5 of those since 2015.
So you've come back each summer and seen in what changes have you noticed? Are they changes that are like showing up in your data, or that you're like, when you go there, you're like, wow, this is really different from last summer, or both?
Yeah. So, the first few years was a really collaborative process. And then since then, it's just been kind of, when we can go, we'll survey them. And the last couple of summers in particular, it's been a really interesting shift. Some of the sites we've seen just exponential increases in density, which is really cool. And a lot of density of like smaller individuals. So a lot of recruitment, or I guess the smaller abalone recruiting to a site. And we've also seen a lot more urchin barrens, which is really interesting for me, because that's more of what we're seeing in California. And so that is sort of a strange shift. And lots of babies. That's great.
Yeah. Well, so I guess it might be helpful to understand. I'm not sure if I'm remembering correctly, abalone are broadcast spawners and then have a planktonic form.
Yeah.
And then they somehow decide somewhere to settle out sometime. How much is known about the actual details of how that all works?
A very particular abalone, like red abalone, a lot is known, and a lot is just sort of presumed to be similar with pinto abalone, and which is funny because pinto abalone span a huge range. I mean, they span from Salisbury Sound down to Baja, Mexico, and it is just I guess they're not as focused on because they're not the large abalone that everyone wants to have in a farm or like have on their plate. So we have these little guys that are just not well known about. But what is limited in terms of our knowledge of their reproductive cycle is basically that they are broadcast spawners and they need to be within 1 meter apart from each other, which I have found is true in Sitka Sound. We look at the neighborhood distances, so the distance between a male and a female, or actually, well, yeah, so the dioecious too, there's males and females, and they have to be within that meter, otherwise just reduced fertilization success, and their plankton are in the water from anywhere between like 8 to 12 days.
It's kind of in between.
Mm-hmm. And they're negatively buoyant, so they don't really have a large range or dispersal, so all those abalone usually will settle right back down into that site after going through their planktonic stage. And we also assume that they recruit to coralline algae. That's that pink crust mm-hmm. on the rocks that you might see at low tide.
Yeah, so if they're within a meter of each other and they're natively buoyant, so they mostly are actually sinking pretty quickly, but they're not attaching. So I guess it's the wave sloshing. So what season are they spawning in? Kind of springtime, or?
That's another awesome question. not exactly known. People have assumed it's somewhere between like May to September, but I've seen them spawning through October, and I've seen them spawning in January. So,
oh
yeah.
So whenever they feel like it.
Yeah. And it might have been something where they were disturbed. Like I know we had big spawning events after I tagged abalone with Megan Six, who was really helpful with tagging these itty bitty 2 millimeter tags on these abalone. And so it was pretty disruptive to them at these sites. And we would go back 3 days later and at two sites, they were all spawning, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah. I suppose in plants, for example, they get under stress sometimes, or if a tree is dying, they'll put out a big fruiting, a lot of cones or something as a little bit of a last hurrah.
Yeah, now's the time.
Yeah, just because. And I suppose there's an advantage to that if you have some sort of trigger to be able to do that and say, okay, I might not make it, but we can get some reproduction happening with the last of my energy. So, yeah, that's an interesting thing. So I guess if they were spawning during a time of storms, I would imagine that that would facilitate greater dispersal, maybe lower. I don't know how if that would mix it too much and they wouldn't actually fertilize. But if they could disperse more in a storm season versus calm season on average, obviously they get around somehow. They can crawl for sure, but they must move. I don't know. Do they ever go really very deep, or if they're getting to an island that's sort of separated by deep water, is it inevitable that they will have gone there as larvae essentially?
Well, our abalone do move a lot. So pinto abalone are the most mobile abalone on the Pacific coast, which is great, but it also makes it really difficult to study them. And from the tagging survey, I think the most telling thing, my main goal from tagging was to document growth, but mostly what I documented was within the same summer, because a lot of those abalone just went away. They just left. It wasn't a tag retention problem. I found an abalone 27 meters away from the exact spot that I tagged it in 3 days later.
Oh, wow.
So they move quite quickly when they want to. And so that said, they are probably in this sort of metapopulation system where there are lots of little populations and probably some larger populations that are sort of the sources for some potentially smaller sink populations. And whether that's from larval dispersal, which is pretty limited with abalone, or literally abalone moving, it would be really cool to know. And just the genetics on that, which would be really helpful for this, are really difficult. Apparently, they're trying to sequence the abalone genome at UC Santa Cruz, where I'm going to grad school, but they are struggling. Apparently, it's not easy.
Yeah, I guess, thinking about it, like, would Baranoff and Chichikov be isolated essentially? Like, I wouldn't imagine they can go deep enough to get across Chatham, for example, if they're going on the floor. I don't know. I don't imagine that they can swim, but sometimes I'm surprised by what critters
can do.
Their
winged stage.
Yeah. Or some sort of weird, like, sometimes things do weird things. They can get up and gallop.
They can, which I think is pretty impressive. But yeah. I don't know about that in terms of I don't think they're quite the nomadic
right, yeah.
types, but they definitely do move a lot. And yeah, maybe the dispersal. But yeah, as far as we know, unless anyone hears of anything else, which would be really great to know, they haven't been seen north of Salisbury Sound.
So. Yeah. Well, and so that's where, you know, even the islands in the Sound, if they really were truly eliminated, I guess maybe it doesn't take a whole lot, or just a couple of individuals that get established there and they can repopulate a thing. Maybe that happens, you know, in the big picture, it's a really small percentage, but if there's a lot of larvae to start with, then you know, even a small percentage will mean enough will filter out to the broader system to keep the islands sort of populated. Because I know like Kitty LeBounty has been collecting the shells that show up on the island from the birds just picking them up and yeah. eating them. And the abalone don't seem like the ones I've been seeing. They don't seem very smart about their time above the water. Like when the tide goes out, like sometimes they're just flopped out. Their shells aren't even tight against the rocks or anything. And
yeah, they don't have much of a defense when they're out of the water. I mean, their whole clamp down system can only work for so long when they're just basically drying out.
Well, and they weren't even clamping when I saw them, but you know, and so the birds seem to be getting them and then just eating them and dropping the shells. But there's a lot of shells. Presumably those are mostly just coming from that island.
Yeah.
You know, so it's interesting to consider just how they are able to disperse and how quickly. And it doesn't seem like the, you know, in recent years, like the most last couple of years, each year it seems like I see bigger ones more easily, but they've been more common as I've been down at the beach. Part of that's because I've been down at the beach more probably, but it also seems like there's just more of them. But it doesn't seem to be located in only one spot or another. It's like wherever I go, I'm seeming to see them.
Yeah, no, and that's what we're finding at these sites and at just random sites as well. I'll survey more than just our 5 monitoring sites. So I usually survey at least 18 sites every summer with both like a shallow and a deep transect. And on both transects, among all size classes, we're seeing, well, in particular, below 50 millimeter size classes. So we're seeing a lot of young of the year and like, yeah, exactly. And they go pretty slowly. So like I would say like 1 to 3 year olds, we're seeing an increase in counts of those, and very few actual like above legal size limit, which is I think interesting to note as well. But it is pretty cool to see that increase. And I've been seeing them more at low tide again. It's just the exact opposite of what's happening, what was happening when I was back in high school. So I was worried it would be like a doom and gloom start to my PhD back in 2015. I was like, oh man, these guys are not doing so hot. But now they're increasing in density, and it's been more of the focus of my questions have been why, which is great.
So you're seeing, are they on average, like, it sounds like you're seeing more of the smaller ones, but also more of the larger ones. And are you seeing a trend in the largest ones? Like if there weren't any big ones to start with, are you each year seeing a few that are larger than the ones before, or is it pretty much been every year you found some of the large ones but not very many?
It really depends on the site. It's actually kind of impressive as to how different they are. And what's fun too is now I get to compare across Southeast Alaska, because I've got sites in Prince of Wales and just north of Dixon Entrance, basically. There's a bunch of islands there. And using some information as well from time swim surveys that were redone, that I helped to redo back in 2016 off Gravina Island and in other areas of Prince of Wales. But so it's like a fun swath to compare. But just in Sitka Sound too, we're seeing that a lot of, I guess just an increase in recruitment. And then sometimes we can follow that sort of small size class into future successive, like that cohort will just like follow. There's been like a bump definitely in the density. So we can like follow it through the years, but which is great because I finally have like 5 years of data, which is amazing to work with. That's the longest term. I don't know. We have so far that I know in the Sound. So it's been cool to watch that increase.
There's not been a lot. There's not been any real long-term monitoring or data collection for abalone.
Yeah, no, just the history generally. Yeah. There are just very few data on historical populations that are independent of the fishery that started in 65 and.
But that was the commercial fishery.
The commercial fishery. So that was an interesting history for abalone and sort of. Abalone following the trajectory of decline following that fishery closure in 95. And that was sort of a emergency closure called after this just inability to find abalone in the same number as before, basically before the peak harvest, which was around 79 to 81 was the peak harvest of abalone. And so since then, they kind of followed this precipitous decline. Even into 2013-ish, there was a report of continued decline of abalone in Southeast Alaska generally. And then the only other real historic data that people are finding and able to use are these time swims that were done, the unpublished data from just a few ADF-NG divers that followed along some commercial divers in different areas. And so some of the sites in Prince of Wales and some of the sites off Gravina Island near Ketchikan are these old sites that folks from ADF-NG dove in the mid-70s to early 80s around the time of the peak harvest. So it's really interesting to sort of compare those counts now to those then.
So they just swam for a certain amount of time and saw how many they saw without like really trying to dig in and turn over all the rocks or whatever.
Yeah, it was pretty non-invasive. It was definitely, it was an interesting survey method. Like time swims are just not as commonly used. I mean, they're really fun to do and I got to do them a lot. You basically just swim along and measure every abalone you see for just 30 minutes and then you're done. So for me right now, I'm doing a little bit more complicated, like basically mapping out where they are in relation to each other, what habitat they're associated with, and getting more than just densities and size classes. But what I can compare to the historic time swims when I do time swims now are the catch per minute or count per minute, and then those size classes. And what I'm finding in across basically all sites is that the size structure of the population has significantly skewed towards smaller size classes. So we're seeing a lot more small abalone and very few abalone above a legal size limit. And at my sites in Prince of Wales, we did sites off the coast. Just generally, it's a very large coast. I feel very comfortable saying just like the outer coast of Dahl Island, which is a very long island. And there, that was hit hard by commercial harvest. And it's really interesting to compare. In particular, there's one graph from like 79 that had over 65% of the abalone were above a legal size limit. And then none of them, which is really obvious, there's none of them were above a legal size limit from the counts that we did this last summer in 2019. So that was pretty telling.
Yeah. Well, and so nobody's been fishing out there presumably since they closed. I mean, I guess somebody could be, but the that seems like a long way out there for sport people to go, for example. It's
and there's just not a lot, and I think that people do realize that out there. I mean, it's amazing diversity of everything else. There's a lot of great understory kelp, and there are actually a lot of great sea stars. Sea star wasting was not there when I was there in 2019, which was nice.
The sunflower stars are still there?
Yeah, there were sunflower stars. There were solasters, some more sun star types that are also voracious predators on abalone. So,
yeah, the sun stars and the solasters, they seem to have been particularly hit by sea star wasting here in my experience. Like I'm once in a while I see a small sun star now, but I haven't seen any of the solasters since the wasting went through. Not that I'm out a huge amount, but...
Well, no, even like for myself, it's been interesting because in 2014, sea star wasting hit Sitka Sound, and that was pretty catastrophic for those Pycnopodia, those sunflower stars, which are big predators of pretty much anything that moves slow enough, even the fast-moving abalone. And so that is one of the research questions that I'm working on is the... are sea stars contributing to this increase in recruitment, right? Because it's hard. We don't have information pre-sea star wasting on our abalone populations and the recruitment then. But I want to follow as sea stars repopulate these sites, what the recruitment is sort of trending towards. And it's been hard because honestly, I haven't had a lot of data on sea stars because sea star wasting keeps on sort of cycling through these sites. And it's been interesting. This summer we did see sea stars not looking so healthy all across the sound. So even north in the sound, in the outer coast, we saw six stars, which was a big bummer. But this February, there were a lot of baby Pycnopodia that I was helping out with the UC Santa Cruz has a really intensive field quarter, and they were doing a lot of diving. And that was that, you know, there's hope. Yes. At least there's enough out there to populate something. So hopefully we'll get something.
Well, it's an interesting, I guess, hypothesis at this point that it's not hard to imagine a scenario where obviously abalone and Pycnopodia coexisted for a long time here. And then, you know, whatever it was that commercial fishing or overharvest of some sort, or just other conditions that suppressed the abalone population. And at that point, then it's not hard to imagine that because the small ones presumably can't move as fast as the larger ones. So maybe once they get to a certain size, then they can get away from the sea stars without too much trouble. And there's enough of them that, you know, they can kind of maintain a higher level of population. But if they get to a certain point, then the sea stars just can keep that suppressed sort of permanently. And so then this would be a release. But yeah, I guess you'd want to have data going back further in time somehow.
Great.
Yeah. To test that hypothesis. But it's an interesting sort of coincidence in time, shall we say, I guess, that mm-hmm. makes you wonder a little bit about that. And I don't know how you would, I mean, sort of short of some sort of aquarium setup where you set up little guys and Pycnopodias and just saw how much carnage the starfish wreaked on them, you know.
That is a bit of what one of our student groups did up here at UC Santa Cruz. Is a little more of a fear response, but it was so hard to find the Pycnopodia to do it. It was pretty interesting.
I remember that being one of Molly Algren's favorite demonstrations in the aquarium get the abalone looks so mellow. And then, but if you put one of the predator starfish near it, it just like goes crazy and just like it can get up and move.
Oh yeah. They twist. They're just like fully twisting and then they just zoom.
Yeah.
I mean, zoom for, you know,
for a mollusk. But yeah, it was kind of impressive. And then sometimes just up and out of the aquarium to get away.
It's the best way to get an abalone off of a rock with any sort of
carry a Pycnopodia in your pocket and
mm-hmm. I like to put them in a shell because they fall apart in my gloves.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that's funny. So the your actual plots, you have these sites and I guess a lot of times I think of plots as being a meter or something square, but I would imagine if you're looking at densities and stuff, probably you want to look at a bigger area than that. What's sort of a you know, the systematic data collection for you? What does that look like? You're underwater. You said you had a low site and a shallow site and a deeper site, and there's a limited amount of time you can be underwater, essentially, mm-hmm. Being an air breather. So. Scuba helps for sure, but I imagine there's just some of those constraints factor into your design. But how is it that you set this up to kind of measure the densities and the things that you're looking at?
Yeah, just basically, particularly at our long-term monitoring sites, it's really nice and easy because we have these buoys we just tie a transect off to, and it's the same every time. And with random sites, we try and place our transects in habitat. We're not just going to be in a sand flat because I've so far found very few abalone and sand flats. But we measure a 40 meter, 2 by 20 meter squared area. And so it's pretty time consuming. And this last summer, we try and add on where we can and remove data if it's not actually helping. So we're basically counting sea stars, the types and size and species. And we're looking at urchins as well. And urchins sort of as a sea otter proxy potentially, and also as a competitor to abalone, because sea urchins, and I've been mentioning, we've seen more sea urchins at these sites, which is really interesting to me. But they eat algae, and so do abalone. And so they can coexist for a while, but urchins are actually much better at munching down whatever algae is around than abalone are. So we wanted to kind of see just that relationship and then also see if we can use them as any sort of sea otter presence, because sea otters love urchins. And generally, as they establish in a site, they will go for urchins and then crabs. And then abalone are just are down on the list, usually because they're a little harder to find or harder to get a hold of. But that's why we're documenting that. And then for each abalone, we've done so many different types of surveys, but this last summer, we were just measuring how far away they are from each transect, how far along the transect they are, so we can kind of grid them out to get that nearest neighbor distance, which is important for reproductive viability of a general snapshot of that population. And yeah, we've done all sorts of other things, like looked at whether they're males and females and what that ratio is, and it's pretty hard to tell. I've been wanting to look at the size of maturity and how, because nobody knows exactly what size of maturity they are. It's generally thought to be over 50 millimeters, but we've seen smaller abalone actually spawning. So that's kind of cool. And looking at comparisons across Southeast Alaska as well, in terms of, well, I want to look at size of maturity, which is great. But also things like exposure. And that's another thing we look at all of our sites. Exposure to predation. So are the abalone out in the open and just ready for the picking, or are they hiding? And you'd mentioned they're not great at hiding in the intertidal at all. No, but like underwater, it's been cool because we found that in areas where there are sea otters present in any amount, they are disproportionately found in cryptic habitat or in cracks and crevices than the more available open habitat. So that's been cool to see that they're, I mean, you can't say they're hiding or like right. It's active or a thought process, but they're definitely in cracks and crevices more often where there are large predators present.
Yeah, I guess it would be the interesting question, and I don't know how you would get at it, but somehow trying to determine whether they figure it out, so to speak, and intentionally go hide under the, which would make some sense, obviously, that, or if there's naturally some that are hidey prone and some that aren't, and the hiders tend to
natural selection,
they survive, basically, yeah. They're still there. You can still find them because they haven't been eaten. But, you know, when I was a kid, and it's been a long time, but when I remember going out abalone picking with my dad, it was at like a island with a lot of kind of boulder, you know, twice the size of your head style kind of rocks and stuff just piled there, and a lot of slippery brown kelp and they were in there, but they always seemed like they were hard to, like, we had to carry putty knives, they always seemed to be pretty locked down. But yeah, when I'm finding them on the beach these days, they're just like all kind of like laid out there. And I don't know why that's the case. Maybe it's just a random thing, or maybe they have not figured it out yet or what. I don't know. But it was kind of interesting. I can't imagine the birds being able to pick the ones but it's been so long. It's a kind of a vague memory. So it's hard to put too much stock in that. It is just kind of a curious thing, though. And so 50 millimeters, just for size-wise, that's like 5 centimeters. So it's a couple inches, not even a couple inches, maybe an inch and a half.
Yeah. And that's what we classify as, like, anything below that, just generally, at least in the surveys that I'm doing here and in surveys down south, so it's comparable. That's sort of less than 50 is sort of more of a juvenile abalone. And then above 50 is sort of more mature abalone. But I kind of want to actually know when abalone are actually mature. And then 89 millimeters is obviously legal. And so we're seeing quite a few up to 50 and then from 50 to like 70. But above 89, even in Sitka Sound, not as many. But what's cool in the Dixon entrance area, where sea otters have yet to establish, and there are lots of urchins, lots of red urchins, and lots of larger abalone size classes, which is pretty cool. And so it's interesting to look throughout. So when you go from areas like our Dixon entrance sites, where there aren't otters, we're seeing lots of larger sizes of abalone, to versus like sites in Prince of Wales, where we're seeing no abalone above 89 millimeters. And there have been otters since they were reintroduced in like the late 60s, and in larger densities than in some areas, like say Sitka Sound, where they were seen in the sound a lot later than when they were reintroduced in the late 60s. And we have sort of an interesting in-between spread of size classes and densities.
Do the abalone occur, I mean, you mentioned Gravina Island before, are they, and that's more inland, but kind of still coming, it's not that far from like Dixon Entrance in that southern open area.
Yeah.
Are they occurring in kind of central and northern inside waters, say mostly an outer coast species?
Oh yeah, no, they're inside waters as well. Yeah, okay. Wherever there's enough algae and Crustaceae coralline from at least, which is amazing here, like in terms of, we've seen some abalone in very protected sites based on like a random point generator that I put, as long as it's within like, you know, 30 feet of the shore, then I'll just go dive there. And every summer, except for one site, I've found an abalone on my random sites, and some of them are not necessary. I want to get a mix of exposed sites to non-exposed mm-hmm. sites. And then same with Gravina Island, closer to Ketchikan even, there are still abalone. And it's a really different scene diving there with complete urchin barrens and abalone, and somehow they're still living together and not totally starving like some of the abalone in California are, which is a big bummer.
You've mentioned urchin barrens a couple times, and I know I talked to Jake, whose last name now?
Metzger.
Yeah, Metzger. Yeah. And he had studied those in the Aleutians, and was just talking about kind of the amazing ways that sea urchins can, you know, eat everything down and then huddle up in the rocks and really just shrink, which seems kind of surprising to me, and hang out for a long time. And just kind of getting by. And I've not really seen, you know, I don't really remember, I wouldn't have known what I was looking at even if I did see them when I was a kid. I certainly saw places where there was plenty of kelp. But the only place that I've seen kind of in recent times that, I don't know if it qualifies as a sea urchin barrens, but it was, because it was, it's in Ayukina, there's a kind of a back mm-hmm. shallow spot there, and there are just hundreds of urchins all, but it's basically in a large tide pool. It's intertidal, but it's always got water in it. Huh. And it's just a large area and kind of a gravel flat. And there's nothing, I was there in February or March, so it was too early for there to be a lot of seaweed in there. But I was like, what are these guys eating? And they were, none of them were very big, but there was a mix of red and green ones. Wow. And there were just bunches of them all in there. I was like, well, the sea otters clearly haven't come in this far, because they would have just chowed down on those. It was all, even at high tide, it would only been, you know, six feet of water maybe. And it was pretty wadeable as it was, which was just kind of surprising to me. But the sea urchin barrens, essentially they eat, and do they eat kelp at the holdfast? Is that kind of what they do?
They'll eat drift kelp first, and then mm-hmm. they'll just aggressively attack kelp. Yeah. So I've seen them climbing kelp and eating it. So like our giant kelp, our Macrocystis here, and just kind of, or they'll make drift kelp, and they'll basically chew off a stipe, or basically what would be otherwise, you know, what you'd think of as like a stem or something. And then, and then there's kelp abounds.
until they get it, it drifts away or they eat it. And that's somebody mentioned seeing more Macrocystis in the Sound than bull kelp. Used to see more bull kelp, now see more Macrocystis. And I was like, I don't really know, but it would make sense to me. Macrocystis is a perennial, so it just keeps regrowing. Mm-hmm. It would be less competitive under a system under a situation where there's a lot of grazers, essentially, that are essentially eating it. Whereas bull kelp grows all in one year, dies back, grows all. So it would be more suited to a situation where it was getting grazed heavily, I would imagine. But I don't really know. That's probably outside the bounds of what you're looking at, but
it is. And I mean, but also it's interesting because it's sort of what was making up the California coastline, where mm-hmm. the red abalone have been under a closure for fishing for the last 2 years or so. And that's due to starvation, basically, because there were a ton of urchins that have taken over and become an urchin baron. And are able to just persist without eating, because Jacob was saying, and I know a few other researchers at UC Santa Cruz just are finding that urchins can basically shrink in on themselves, and I don't know how they do it, but digest their gonads as well, which makes them sort of unpalatable to anything like an otter for eating them. So there could be urchin barrens that are just completely overlooked by otters because they, what would they eat, basically this calcium crusty thing. So it's interesting because some of those predators have learned to not eat urchins and urchin barrens, and so urchin barrens just persist until something like a disease wipes them out, which is sort of this boom bust cycle of a lot of echinoderms. But particular instances I can't really totally speak towards, but the bull kelp was the sort of dominant algal forest there, and it just hasn't come back, even when people are using things like urchin vacuum cleaners to try and vacuum. Yes, this is actually happening. You should look it up. You should check out what an urchin vacuum cleaner is. I mean, this is my personal opinion. It seems like a drop in a bucket to a giant, giant field of basically battlefield of urchins that are just waiting for some poor little sporophyte to like land and maybe create kelp because they're just on it immediately. So, yeah, the abalone basically in those areas are not doing so hot and are starving because there just isn't anything for them, which is a huge bummer. And maybe it's because Nereo is harder to come back, but also there's no macro, so it's very hard to know.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
For me.
Is this in the Monterey Bay or is it along the coast? Or
it's Mendocino and Sonoma counties on mm-hmm. the shores there. There used to be just insane kelp forests and great abalone diving. It was really intensely managed. There had been talk of a closure for a while, but really it was associated with like warm water, killing off some of the kelp because they can't hold things like the nitrates they need in warm water and they just don't do that well. And again, I'm just an invert biologist, but it's an ecosystem. So
right, yeah.
It's good to know at least a little thing or two about what's going on there. But so the kelp died back and urchins were hungry because warm water increased metabolism. So eating and then abalone were just not as quick on the whole eating bit. And they also can't just persist without kelp like urchins can, these crazy zombie creatures.
Yeah. I guess it's a situation that from the sounds of it, it's kind of like an environmental factor, you know, outside factor came in and suppressed the kelp. And then there wasn't enough kelp. And then the urchins finished it off at that point, at which point they started to digest their good bits that other things like to eat and became unpalatable. And it was just this negative feedback loop that kind of,
yeah, that's my understanding of it.
Created the need for sea urchin vacuums, which I'll have to look up. That sounds,
yes.
That sounds sadly funny, I guess, maybe. But it does.
Depends on whether you want urchins or you don't want urchins in an area, I guess.
Well, the fact that it's needed, I guess, maybe is that. But yeah, the big urchin barons. And I remember speaking with Jacob. That was, if folks are interested, there's the recordings on my site if they want to listen to hear more about the urchin barons that he was and sea urchins that he was studying out in the Aleutians. But so in Sitka, you were mentioning 50 millimeters, which is a little more than half legal size, I guess, mm-hmm. if 89 is the legal. How small were you measuring them to? Like, what's the smallest guys that you were
Oh,
finding?
Man. Once you start seeing them, just tiny, tiny. I've measured like 5-6 millimeter abalone, and they're just little fruity pebbles. And as soon as you see them, you just see them everywhere. So it's fun and sort of frustrating as soon as I see a site with a ton of recruitment because I have to measure every single one of them.
Oh, no. An over 20-meter transect, that would
be... Yeah, 20-by-2-meter transect. Yeah. It's great. No, but it's been cool because I want to pay attention to those little ones and look at where they're associating themselves. Are they, like, what kind of habitat they're most associated with? So this summer I was mostly measuring and doing basic habitat stuff, but then my lovely dive buddy Henry would go behind me and take photos of that basic habitat with the abalone in them and the available habitat that's without abalone in them. So basically, where do abalone associate within these transects based on what's there? So that is what I'm going through right now. Slowly are these photo plots, these basic like half meter by half meter squares of basically data at this point.
Yeah.
A bunch of algae, which is cool. And so hopefully I can figure out where smaller abalone are higher in density and if that's due to kelp or urchins or sea stars or what. So
these guys are starting out pretty little. You mentioned that you did I don't know if you just did that for 1 year or if you've done it each year, but tagging studies and it made me wonder because I remember I found an abalone. It was actually one of the largest ones I've seen. I think it was just over legal size last summer. But its shell was really worn, like the outer part of it was really worn down. And I was like, I don't know if they are. It was in an area where there was a sandy beach nearby, so maybe there was sand in the water that would abrade it more. But I don't really know how. I mean, obviously they're growing from small, so they're building their shell is getting bigger. It isn't like a snail that just keeps growing out and the inner part stays the same. I mean, they are related to snails, but I guess I don't quite know if they're adding layers at the outer part or how they're growing bigger. But to what extent can they sort of repair a shell that gets abraded, or is that pretty much the shell they have is the one they have and they can't really do too much?
They can heal a little bit, which is cool. And I've found just in measuring shells, I'm like, that was definitely that abalone was broken. But what's crazy too is they're hemophiliac. So if they get cut to a certain point, they really, if their tissue, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And so that's why in collecting them, like I always use a Pycnopodia or a sunflower star. Cause if I'm collecting them, say for like the aquarium in town, or if I'm collecting them for lab surveys or to put a tag on them, I don't want to cut them because then that kind of defeats the whole purpose. But in terms of their shell, they can repair their shell. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so long as there's enough aragonite and calcite in the water for them to repair their shells with, which is a whole other story.
Well, that actually reminds me of something. And I don't know, it sounds like you had a chance to do some work off of Doll Island. And I know Doll Island is got a lot of limestone.
And
so,
Prince of Wales, so
yeah,
awesome.
So much limestone in that area as opposed to here. And I was kind of curious if there's any reason to think that having that large calcium source, I guess, it seems like right near the water or even in the water, the substrate on which the other things are growing, to what extent, I mean, I know on land it has an effect on what plants grow there, for example, but I don't know if it would have an effect on the intertidal stuff. It would create a buffering in the water or if there's anything like that, or if that's been something that anybody's looked at.
Yeah, I don't know of anyone looking at that, but if anyone does, they should. I would be very, very, very curious. But I do know things like the shell morphology will change based on exposure. So people have found with other abalone, not pintos yet, but that the shells will be sort of more streamlined in areas where there's a higher surf and higher wave impact versus say a cove where they're more protected.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense because the water's pretty powerful. It could rip things off if you have, or just creates a lot more tension, I guess. If you just takes more energy to hold yourself on, I suppose. Yeah. If nothing else. So yeah, I guess it'd be something maybe somebody will study sometime is just like what the effect, especially under, you know, one of the effects of climate change stuff is the increased acidity of the water. But I would naively perhaps imagine that being near limestone would buffer that to a certain extent because it would just dissolve more limestone. But I don't know if that's how it works or not. So maybe somebody someday I'll talk to. We'll have some.
There are definitely some OA experts in this town.
Yeah. So that's it's just a question that I've been curious about. And especially for something that lives on, you know, the shell creatures that live on the bottom of the various sorts, the mollusks and so forth. So you mentioned the size in Dixon Entrance where they're not sea otters there, that you were finding more large ones, relatively speaking. And I guess I'm curious if, I mean, I don't know how you would know the answer to this, so maybe it's a question that you can't answer, but presumably there was commercial fishing that happened during that time. The population, you know, decreased there as well as elsewhere. But if there was no, I guess, were there the predator starfish there and things like what other differences were there besides, or were there any other differences other than obviously it's further south. Maybe they grow faster when it's warmer water. I don't know if it's warmer water down there. Yeah. Like, are there other factors that might be contributing to the sort of differences that you're seeing?
Well, yeah, why I like the site so much is that, one, it's incredibly remote, so it is really hard to get out to. We saw some charter fishing boats from Ketchikan out there, but it is a solid slog to get out to basically the middle of Dixon Entrance, and it is super weather dependent, and so it's not just an easy location for even commercial harvesters to go to, so they might not have been hit as hard. I don't know. The crazy thing about the whole commercial fishery is there aren't more site-specific catch. There's just like a general, like, this region, zone is this much. And southern Southeast Alaska was hit a lot harder by the commercial. It was just more successful in the southern half of Southeast Alaska. And there were actually more restrictions on areas like Sitka in terms of the commercial harvest. But so it was interesting in Dixon Entrance because I knew there was a higher take generally in that region, a very large region, but it's harder access and there are fewer otters. And there are some otters there that are, there's some like forays by the few maybe male otters that are checking it out, but it's still pretty dense with sea urchins. There's still a sea urchin fishery there. And it's kind of impressive and it quite a wild place. So I think maybe just because it's farther away, harder to get to. And yeah, who knows what else? Maybe it's, it has to do with the understory. There's really great understory there, but not quite as much as Prince of Wales. I think that has to do more with my habitat analyses, which hopefully I'll have for you here in a little bit.
Yeah, well, I know you have some time left so to complete your studies and and we'll be interested in following up later if there's an opportunity to get some other conclusions from the remainder of your work. But the you mentioned, so Pinto Abalone, I think you said they went from Salisbury Sound in the north, and I can't remember where you said in the South, California?
Bahia de Tortugas.
Oh, so down into Mexico.
Mexico.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. So and there is, and I guess that was kind of the curiosity you mentioned with sea urchins, that their metabolism increases with increase in water temperature. Is there a sense of, like, what's the effect of warm water? Presumably, I know that there's the offshore winds that create that cold water upwelling there, so the difference in marine ecology is not as great as one might expect simply from latitude, but it still is warmer down there, I think, than it is here. Mm-hmm. What effect does that have on the abalone in terms of their growth and the way that they show up?
That's a good question. I don't 100% know in terms of affecting the abalone. I do know that the abalone are found deeper, though, in Southern California. And so people like Amanda Bird, who are working on Pinto Abalone in Southern California and in the Channel Islands, she finds them on her white abalone transects. And so white abalone were like the first endangered abalone. And so there's just a lot of work on those guys. But sort of it started as a, oh, let's document these other abalone as well that are down here. And these Pinto abalone are like 80 feet deep, which is really deep and is not where we would find them here in Southeast. We kind of stopped seeing Pinto abalone at around 35 feet. They're at 60 feet every once in a while, but it's not, the majority of them are actually shallower than deeper. And a lot of the thought behind that is because our kelp forests are also a lot shallower than in, say, Southern California. And so potentially that's it. Maybe there's just like food down there, or maybe it's because it's colder. So yeah, I'm not quite sure.
I guess the kelp. Yeah. I didn't realize that our kelp forests tended to be more shallow, but I suppose that the light is more intense down there. So it's more directly overhead. So it would penetrate further. I would guess. I don't know.
We have a lot of plankton too in the water diving here in the summer for anyone who's,
I have heard that. Yeah. It gets a little cloudy here.
Yeah, it's about to get really cloudy soon.
Yeah, I suppose that all happens pretty fast, doesn't it? Once it switches, it's like, oh.
Yeah, herring season on, it just kind of starts to be super productive, which is great and important, but it's hard as a diver sometimes.
Yeah, I imagine so. Yeah, so you mentioned you did a couple of sort of off-summer, sounds like most of your work's done in the summer, but one thing I was kind of curious about, and maybe you are too, but maybe it's not very easy to study, is you mentioned that they A, can move a lot, and B, are better off if they're close by each other for spawning purposes. Like, do they rearrange themselves for spawning? Do they like gather up at some level? Everybody in the neighborhood says, all right, time to get together. Or is there a sense of whether that happens, or they're just like, well, we're here. I get the feeling in the water. Let's go.
Right. Yeah. And that's a great question. And definitely good to look at things like temporally. And I, with the help of Lauren Bell, my dive buddy from the start on the abalone work that started in 2015, we did some winter dives and looked at more of a neighborhood distance in the winter compared to in the summer. And it was not statistically different. And they're both aggregated, which is cool because it makes sense. Abalone are just generally aggregated as a species. So they just are generally close to each other and not sort of normally distributed. But they weren't any more aggregated. And what's interesting is they when they're spawning, and when I've seen them spawning, and from the one paper in 91 on them spawning in Whiting Harbor, is that males will stack on top of each other. So literally just their neighbor distance is zero. Like right. They are literally on top of each other. And they will release their gametes into the water, and then females will just, as they are just generally aggregated, sort of release their eggs, which are this beautiful color green, into the water. And then hopefully they're close enough. Hopefully they're within 1 meter. And we've seen recruitment at sites that are much lower, like within, I don't want to say exactly, but it's definitely below 0.5 meters. We've seen recruitment at sites. And so it's interesting. And then maybe it's because they're moving a lot closer for those spawning events, but there was no real difference in the winter to the summer when we did compare.
Yeah, I suppose if they can spawn year round, I mean, I don't know. It doesn't sound like people have done enough work to have a sense of what might trigger spawning. You mentioned that just handling them seemed to be a trigger for spawning. So it would be, if they're capable of spawning year round, then I imagine they could rearrange in a matter of a day or two.
Oh, and, they're so
and then
quick.
Go back to their
I believe it.
Normal density of aggregation. Well, so that's an interesting thing, I guess. So the question that comes up for me then is with the they have preferred habitat, the kelp, and I guess you said when they're small they seem to like the coral and algae in particular. I don't know if they're eating it or if they just like it's a good place to hide, kind of thing. I don't remember if it was abalone, if it was something else that I heard about. There's something about coral and algae. Maybe it was abalone, but that triggers the settling.
It triggers their metamorphosis, yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, they haven't proven it in pinto abalone, but across a few abalone species, they've found that it triggers their sort of settlement and metamorphosis into a small abalone.
So how old, presumably you said 8 to 12 days they settle out. I'm guessing that you don't see, you can't see them at that size, that they're just too small.
Yeah, you need a, yeah.
So is it like a few months before they're big enough for you to start counting or seeing? Or
that's a good question. Yeah, it's definitely, it's hard to know because growth rates are different even across Southeast Alaska, which is something I'm also looking into without tagging, more with modeling. But I'm not 100% sure. And what I want to do too, which would be maybe too much for my PhD, but maybe after, there's an idea of like rinsing rocks, and they've done it with red. Laura Rogers Bennett and Cynthia Catton have done it in California with red abalone. And they basically grab a rock, rinse whatever's on it, and then look for baby abalone. And then, but from I think hatchery reports, I don't remember. It's a few months before they can see them with their bare eye, and I don't really know from there how much more quickly they grow. But it would be cool almost to backtrack and see when they respond, if you can kind of get that information. So I don't know. It's a bit of a pipe dream at this point, but it would be cool to know when they're spawning and if it correlates with any like warm weather or storm events. And then also to kind of figure out how long it takes for them to grow from there.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when you're mentioning them aggregating together, so does that mean they're not really fully utilizing the habitat? They're just kind of like, I don't know, I'm thinking abalone herd, but, you know, the herd of abalone sort of grazing the plains of algae or whatever, but very slowly, although faster than you might expect.
Yeah.
Is that kind of the idea, or are they sort of, is some of the aggregating just a consequence of the patchiness of the preferred habitat?
Ooh, I think it could be both, really. I mean, as a species, generally they aggregate, and I always sort of test if they're aggregating at sites, and they are. So it's just that they're not like randomly distributed.
Right.
Yeah. They're not randomly distributed. They're just generally closer to each other than they would be otherwise. And it's also why I still measure things like nearest neighbor distance, because counts like density. You could basically take a snapshot and say in that snapshot of your abalone population, you just have like a cluster in one corner of abalone. And so you've just like missed the rest of that whole aggregation, basically. And you've just gotten a little snapshot of it. Your density would be really off, or say you just hit that aggregation only. So it's kind of a better measure of I guess just a better idea of what an abalone population is, and depending on your questions that you're asking. But densities can be misleading sometimes, and so that's why some of the time swim stuff is kind of, it's kind of hard to use in terms of a density analysis, more of like great for size classes and understanding those shifts. But yeah, so that's why we're trying to gather as much as we can on these guys.
Yeah. Yeah, I just like, it's been a while since I did any spatial statistics stuff, but it's like, oh yeah, all that stuff about like random versus clustered and the way that it's clustered variance and all mean, those yeah, things. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. There's different ways that they look at to study those things. And then looking at, yeah, in a naturally patchy habitat, which actually reminds me. So you had mentioned that one of the things that can disrupt a sea urchin barren is, you know, disease coming through, but it mm-hmm. also occurred to me that, disturbance, other sorts of disturbance, and I don't know how often those happen on a geological time frame. They happen pretty often, but mm-hmm. on the abalone life scale and our life scale, not so often.
Yeah.
You know, one major disturbance was the invention of a bunch of new rocky habitat when they put in the breakwaters, for example.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I just remember watching, especially when they added that last section to close off the open part there, kind of just in from John Brown's Beach, that in the first year, you know, when they first put it in, of course, it was all just bare rock. Mm-hmm. And then the first year, there was definitely some things that were there, but it still looked very different than the older breakwater.
Yeah.
And then over time, it got to look more and more like the older breakwater, and it just raised questions in my mind about succession in intertidal, subtidal, probably habitats and kind of disturbance regimes there. And I can't imagine that. I mean, probably somebody somewhere has done some sort of studies on these sorts of things. But I was curious if you know anything about, that sort of event, those kind of events where there would be a major disturbance and things just have to kind of come back in and get started again.
Right. Not in Southeast Alaska. And I'm sure that there are disturbances that we just aren't documenting. There's just so much going on under the water. Yeah. But like in New Zealand with that whole earthquake that brought a bunch, I just remember seeing photos of these abalone just drying out because the intertidal had just been like shifted up and then it was completely out of the water by like,
oh yeah, like
15
what happened
feet.
In the 64 quake up north, there was places that had that kind of a shift where the
intertidal was no longer the intertidal.
Right.
Yeah. And so that was sort of sad to see, but that would have obviously fundamentally shifted that ecosystem. And yeah, I think a really big disturbance was really the sea star wasting. That would have been, I mean, in a different, it, again, is a disease that hit, well, technically we don't really know what sea star wasting is. So sea star wasting syndrome, whatever you want to call it, but the die-off of sea stars has been really, I think a big piece of that too, because Pycnopodia also eat urchins, and so something like them coming back would be really interesting.
Yeah, well, maybe. Yeah,
and that's why I'm like accounting for all of these other species outside of abalone, because it's really, it's a community effort.
Yeah, well, it is. It yeah, ecosystems are complicated, and I guess part of what makes the inner and subtidal stuff, it's just so diverse and such a rich but concentrated. It's all concentrated in that kind of a zone, and gives you a lot to look at for better and worse.
And a lot more questions the more you look at it.
Yeah,
it's great.
I think that probably makes a lot of sense. The more you look, the more you're like, wait a minute, this is more complicated than I hoped. But I'm excited now. So, any last thoughts that you have before we wrap up here?
Oh man, it's just wonderful to work in the ecosystems here in Southeast Alaska. I'm just feeling lucky, and I would love to talk to anyone who wants to talk to me about abalone or things otherwise related to it. So,
what's the best way to get in touch with you if somebody wants to chat about abalone or other?
Yeah, you
marine.
Can marine anything. Yeah, I'm very much into that. Well, I'm around town for the next month of April 2020. But otherwise, you can find me on the Raimundi Carr website, which is my advisor, Pete Raimundi at UC Santa Cruz. That's our lab website. And you can also find out all the other fun research that people in my lab are doing, including things on urchin barrens and many other kelp forest projects. And you could find me there or at twhite1@ucsc.edu.
All right, great. And I will post a link to the lab website when I post the show on my site. Well, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded with Taylor White this past week. I want to thank her for taking some time out of her schedule to visit with me, and thank you for joining me here on the Sitka Nature Show. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. Until next time, when it will officially be spring, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.